Hello. I am Professor Cosmo. And this is KWMR in Point Reyes Station.
KWMR would like to thank its booster sponsor, Point Reyes Adventure Co., offering tours and rentals from kayaking to backpacking and day trips to overnights. More information at pointreyesadventureco.com.
KWMR is supported by listeners and by Black Mountain Cycles, Point Reyes Station's local bike shop, proud to support community radio and KWMR. Black Mountain Cycles is located on Main Street and can be found on the web at blackmtncycles.com or at 415-663-8125.
Good morning. Oh, there we are. Good morning to and welcome to Turning Pages. I'm Matt Gallagher, and I'm on Mondays now, as I've read in the roundup by Amanda Eichstadt. Normally, you've been listening to Amanda in this slot on Turning Pages on Mondays, and I decided that I would give it a try to see if I can read out loud on the radio, and I've picked a fairly interesting piece to start with. It's not that long of nonfiction, we'll call it, and it's A Briefer History of Time, From the Big Bang to the Big Mac by Eric Schulman. And the reason why we can read something that is not from the public domain is because Eric Schulman wrote this as the Creative Commons fair use and attribution. As long as we give him credit, you can do it on the radio. You can even add to it, I believe, share alike. And that allows us to have this text. And we thank Eric Schulman here at KWMR 90.5 FM. Again, Turning Pages. Let us begin. This is copyright 1999 to 2004. Eric Schulman, some rights reserved. You're free to copy, distribute, display, and perform this work as long as you give the original author credit. Do not use this work for commercial purposes and do not alter, transform, or build upon this work. You must make clear to others the license terms of this work before you distribute it. The full Creative Commons public license can be found at the end of this file. First printing, 1999. Electronic release, 2004. This book is dedicated to Emily. I don't pretend to understand the universe. It's a great deal bigger than I am. Thomas Carlyle, December 28, 1868. A Briefer History of Time, The History of the Universe in 100 Words or Less. Quantum fluctuation, inflation, expansion, particle-antiparticle annihilation, deuterium and helium production, recombination, galaxy formation, turbulent fragmentation, massive star formation, stellar evolution, iron production, supernova explosion, star formation, planetary differentiation, volatile gas expulsion, molecular reproduction, protein construction, fermentation, cell differentiation, respiration, multicellular organisms, sexual reproduction, evolutionary diversification, trilobite domination, land exploration, comet collision, dinosaur extinction, mammal expansion, Homo sapiens manifestation, language acquisition, glaciation, innovation, religion, animal domestication, food surplus production, inscription, warring nations, empire creation and destruction, civilization, constitution, industrialization, world conflagrations, fission explosions, computerization, space exploration, population explosion, superpower confrontation, internet expansion, resignation, reunification, World Wide Web creation, composition, extrapolation. A not quite so brief history of time. The preface, quantum fluctuation, chapter one, inflation, expansion, particle antiparticle annihilation, deuterium and helium production, recombination, etc., etc. These are our chapters coming up. Galaxy formation, 15, turbulent fragmentation, in which the giant cloud of gas fragments into smaller clouds, which become protostars, massive star formation, in which massive stars formed, stellar evolution, iron production, all the things that we've read. That's the table of contents. And we're at the end. No, we're at the preface now. I decided to write a popular book about the history of the universe after I participated in the 7th annual Ig Nobel Prize ceremony at Harvard University in 1997. A considerable number of such books had already been written, of course, ranging from the very informative and humorous, such as Larry Gonick's The Cartoon History of the Universe, to the not-so-informative or humorous, which I will not identify. However, I felt that none of them really addressed the questions that had led me to study science in the first place. Where are we now? Where have we been? Is there an amusing and informative way of describing the journey? These questions are all of interest to us all, or at least to all of us reading this particular book. The 20th century saw scientific fields becoming so complex that the only a small number of specialists are able to master their techniques and the mathematics used to describe them. And very few of these people have the time and inclination to write amusing books describing the highlights, not only of their own field, but also of other relevant fields. This is what I have attempted to do in this book. It is up to the reader to judge whether I have succeeded. I read somewhere that each equation included in a popular science book will have the sales, but that this effect does not occur with Einstein's famous E equals mc squared equation. Can you guess which equation I included in this book? In reading this book, I will probably encounter some terms. You will probably encounter some terms which you are unfamiliar. You will not be tested on those terms, but should you wish to review them, feel free to use the extensive glossary at the end of the book. Each of the 53 chapters in this book represent a significant event in the history of the universe. The first page of each chapter lets you know where and when the event occurred. Time points early in the history of the universe and give the time elapsed since the Big Bang. These are usually written in scientific notation. You can look at the glossary entry on scientific notation for more information on how to interpret these numbers. Thank you for buying this book. If you are just browsing, please reread this sentence after you purchase it. If you have checked it out of the library, please thank the librarian and suggest that extra copies be ordered. I hope that you enjoy it, that you learn from it, and that you recommend it to friends, relatives, co-workers, acquaintances, bartenders, bus drivers, flight attendants, random passers-by, and pretty much anyone else you happen to meet. Eric Schulman, Alexandria, Virginia, December 16th, 1998. 10 to the negative 43 seconds after the Big Bang. The universe, quantum fluctuation in which our universe begins. Once upon a time, long ago and far away, there was a universe very much like our own. It had dogs and cats and people, some of whom preferred the dogs and some who preferred the cats. And trigoencephalopodic nochies and other things which you've never heard of because we haven't encountered them yet. Like our own universe, this one was infinite in size. And one interesting thing about infinite universes is that anything that has even a slight chance of happening will be happening somewhere, even if the probability is very, 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 Now, it just so happened that one of the effects of quantum mechanics was that large amounts of matter and energy could spontaneously appear, even though this rarely happened in a given volume of space. Well, on this particular once upon a time, an entire universe appeared. Its density was more than 1,000 billion 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 times that of water, and its temperature was more than 100,000 billion 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 degrees Fahrenheit. It immediately began to expand, become less dense, and cool off. Luckily for the inhabitants of the first universe, the new universe quickly became detached from the old universe and started expanding into a completely different four-dimensional volume of space. This is the story of that universe and some of the things that have happened during its last 14 billion years. 10 to the negative 37 seconds after the Big Bang. Quantum fluctuation, in which the grand unified force separates into the four forces of nature as we know them, and the universe expands to many times its original size in a very short period of time. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another beautiful diurnal period here at Universal Downs. We're ready for the start of what should be a most exciting cosmological derby. There are just four forces competing today, but each and every one of them is a champion in its own right. In the starting position, it's gravity. Next is strong nuclear, weak nuclear, and finally, a young filly named electromagnetism. All four forces are lined up and unified at the starting gate, waiting for the bell to announce the moment of the Big Bang, which will start this exciting race to determine which is the strongest force in the universe. There's a starting bell, and they're off. At 10 to the negative 43 seconds, it's weak nuclear neck and neck with electromagnetism and strong nuclear, with gravity bringing up the rear. It's still a little early in the race, folks, just 10 to the negative 38 seconds, but it looks like strong nuclear might be making its move. Yes, at 10 to the negative 37 seconds, strong nuclear has broken away from electromagnetism and weak nuclear. The energy density is astounding, ladies and gentlemen. The universe is expanding exponentially. This is turning out to be a real Donnybrook. We're at 10 to the negative 36 seconds, and it's still going. 10 to the negative 35 seconds, 10 to the negative 34 seconds. Oh, wait, what's this? It's 10 to the negative 33 seconds, and I think, yes, indeed, ladies and gentlemen, the transition to broken symmetry is complete at 10 to the negative 32 seconds. Strong nuclear is now about 14 times stronger than electromagnetism, and the universe is more than a billion, 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 billion times larger than it was at 10 to the negative 37 seconds. The crowd is going wild, and they're throwing their sombreros into the air and shouting, Higgs! 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 The four forces separated through a process called spontaneous symmetry breaking caused by the Higgs field, whose potential is sort of a sombrero-shaped. While the fundamental particle physicists frown at the lack of precision in this explanation, the rest of us may continue to the next chapter, which discusses parking places. Such a magnificent showing by strong nuclear. What a force! 10 to the negative 32 seconds after the Big Bang. Expansion, in which the universe continues to expand, though not quite as quickly. The universe is expanding, but for some reason it never gets any easier to find a parking place. There are a couple reasons for this. First, the universe is expanding very slowly. You should have to wait 65 million years for a one-mile block in the middle of space to expand enough to produce another parking space. The other reason is that the gravitational attraction between all of the particles in the Earth completely overcomes the expansion of the universe. So even if you circled a block on Earth for 65 million years, it wouldn't get any bigger. Taking public transportation would be a much more efficient use of your time. But if the universe is expanding, what is it expanding into? In order to answer that question, let us imagine ourselves to be two-dimensional creatures living on the surface of a balloon. The only directions we know are backwards, forwards, and right, left. Only the mathematicians among us have any concept of up, down, and everyone else suspects that they are probably just making it up. Eventually, however, some two-dimensional astronomers discover that the balloon is expanding. How could that be? To an outside, that is to say, three-dimensional observer, it would be obvious. The balloon is increasing in volume, and the surface of the balloon, the two-dimensional universe, is increasing in area. However, these concepts are quite difficult for the two-dimensional inhabitants of balloon land. So, am I saying that our universe is like a three-dimensional balloon expanding into a four-dimensional space? Well, maybe. But that would imply the universe has a finite volume. Astronomers call this type of universe closed, and it will eventually stop expanding and begin to recollapse. While this is possible, many astronomers now consider it to be unlikely. So, what is the universe really like? It appears most likely that the universe is infinite, in extent open, and will continue to expand forever, which implies that it is a three-dimensional hyperbolic paraboloid in four-dimensional space. Think of it as the four-dimensional representation of a three-dimensional saddle. Or, better yet, try not to worry about it at all. It won't make any easier to find a parking space. 1 second after the Big Bang. Particle-antiparticle annihilation, in which all the antiparticles in the universe annihilate almost all the particles, creating a universe made up of matter and photons. The first book of Gamow, called Origins. Chapter 1, in which the universe is transformed. In the beginning, God created the particles and the antiparticles. Footnote A. Antiparticles are very much like particles, except that when particles and antiparticles meet, they completely destroy each other and emit a burst of an energetic radiation. Now, the temperature was high, and the particles and the antiparticles were in equilibrium, and the Spirit of God was hovering. Footnote B. In a four-dimensional sense, God does not move in mysterious ways sometimes. The Spirit of God was hovering over the universe. Origins 1. 2. And God said, "Let there be light." And some particles and antiparticles annihilated each other to produce photons, and there was light. God saw that the light was good, and he separated the photons from the particles and antiparticles. God called the photons bosons, and the particles and antiparticles he called fermions. And there was pair production, and there was photon creation, the first 10 to the negative 43 seconds. 3. And God said, "Let there be exponential expansion of the universe to separate one part from another." So God made an exponential expansion of the universe that separated the magnetic monopoles from each other so that all attempts to find one would be futile. And it was so. God called the exponential expansion inflation. And there was vacuum energy density, and there was inflation, the first 10 to the negative 32 seconds. 4. And God said, "Let the antiparticles and the particles be gathered together, and let photons appear." And it was so. God called the few remaining particles matter, and the annihilated antiparticles he called antimatter. And God saw that it was good, and there were neutrons, and there were protons, the first second. 5. And God said, "Let there be nuclear reactions to produce heavier elements." And it was so. God made protons and neutrons combine to produce deuterium nuclei, and the deuterium nuclei he combined to make helium nuclei. And there was also some lithium, and there also was some beryllium, the first 3 minutes. He called some of the particles and antiparticles bosons as well, but that's another story. Origins. 6. And God said, "Let the universe teem with energetic photons, and let electrons fly past atomic nuclei." And it was so. God blessed the particles and said, "Be fruitful and produce neutral atoms." And the radiation became less energetic, and the electrons combined with atomic nuclei. And God saw that it was good. And there was background radiation, and there were neutral atoms, the first 380,000 years. And God said, "Let the density perturbations produce collections of matter according to their kinds, stars, galaxies, and clusters of galaxies, each according to its kind." And it was so. God made the clusters of galaxies according to their kinds, and the galaxies according to their kinds, and the stars according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let us make gravity in our image, in our likeness, and let it rule over the superclusters of galaxies, over the clusters of galaxies, over the groups of galaxies, over the clusters of stars, and over the solar systems." God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was violent relaxation and virilization the first billion years. By the first billion years, God had finished the work he had been doing. So after the first billion years, he rested from all his work, and God blessed the remaining time in the universe and made it holy, because during it, he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. 1 second after the Big Bang. Deuterium and helium production, in which many of the protons and neutrons in the early universe combined to form heavy hydrogen and helium. The taming of the sneutrino, the persons of the play. Petruchio, a proton. Grumio, a neutron. Petrumio, a deuteron. Hortensio, a deuteron. Petrumcio, a helium nucleus. Act 1, Scene 1, Padua, a public place, before the spatial domain of Hortensio. Enter Petruchio and Grumio. Petruchio, "Verona, for a while I take my leave, to see my friends in Padua, but of all my best beloved and approved friend, Hortensio, I trow this in his spatial domain. Here, sirrah Grumio, knock, I say." Grumio, "Knock, sir? Whom should I knock? Is there any particle you have re-abused your worship?" Petruchio, "Villain, I say knock me here soundly." Grumio, "Knock you, sir? Why, sir, what am I, sir, that which I should knock you here, sir?" Petruchio, "Villain, I say knock me at this energy barrier and wrap me well, or I'll knock your knave's hair." Grumio tunnels through Petruchio's energy barrier, producing Petrumio, a deuteron. Enter Hortensio. Hortensio, "How now? What's the matter, my old friend Grumio and my good friend Petruchio? How came you from Verona and into Petrumio?" Petrumio tunnels through Hortensio's energy barrier, producing Petrumcio, a helium nucleus. Exit Petrumcio. 380,000 years after the Big Bang. Recombination, in which electrons combined with hydrogen and helium nuclei, producing neutral atoms. "Okay, atoms, let's get ready to do the recombination square dance. Alaman left photon hits on you, electron escapes, now you're through. One on the right comes to your aid, meet a new electron and promenade. While protons are hot, electrons are gone. With photons cold, electrons come. The universe expands and cools, so join your partner, obey the rules. With photons flying far and wide, keep your electrons by your side. While you may think this dance is square, fusion is coming, so take care. You'll have a billion years of calm before galaxies start to form. But once the stars begin to shine, you'll be missing the peaceful time. 10 billion years B.C. The galaxy. Galaxy formation, in which the Milky Way galaxy forms. All the news from everywhere. Prices may vary in areas outside the local supercluster. The Daily Universe, Monday, June 21st, 10 billion years B.C. Major galaxy forms in unfashionable cluster. Could life develop there? Local group, 10 billion years BC, another major galaxy formed today in the Local Group, a collection of about 24 galaxies located on the outskirts of the large Virgo cluster of galaxies. The new spiral galaxy has a mass of 500 billion solar masses, about 2 million billion 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 pounds, and a diameter of 100,000 light years, a little less than a billion billion miles. It is the second large galaxy to form in the Local Group in the past 100 million years. Whether life will develop within either of these galaxies is still an open question. The first stars formed just after the pre-galactic cloud began to collapse, and many of them reside in one of the hundreds of globular clusters in the new galaxy, one observer reported. Globular clusters contain hundreds of thousands of stars and orbit the new galaxy along elliptical paths. The stars here are mostly hydrogen and helium, so it is not expected that many planets will form, making it unlikely for life to arise around these stars. As a pre-galactic cloud began to collapse in earnest, the cloud's slight rotation became faster and faster, and the stars and gas formed a disk. This thin layer of stars and gas looks like a phonograph record and is rotating around the center of the galaxy at a speed of about 500,000 miles per hour, says another expert. It is expected that the intense star formation in this region of the new galaxy will result in large amounts of the elements needed to form planets and life. The chances for life may be highest near the center of the galaxy, where the star formation is most intense. However, it is possible that supernova explosions will sterilize planets that orbit stars close to the center of the galaxy. When asked to rate the chances of the first life in this galaxy arising as far away as 30,000 light years from the center of the galaxy, one expert estimated the probability to be absurdly small. 9 billion years BC. Turbulent fragmentation, in which giant cloud of gas fragments into smaller clouds, which become protostars. A stellar nursery. If you're like me, you've probably looked up at the sky countless times to admire the beautiful starry night and wish that you could have the same effect in your own home. You can, because this month's issue of Martha Stellar Living is devoted to learning how to make a star. I love stars because they provide an opportunity to be so wonderfully creative with such simple ingredients. The variations are endless. That cloud of gas you probably have in your garden could be turned into an old standby, such as a sun-like yellow star. And simply by adding a bit of mass, you can easily produce a brilliant blue supergiant. It's just the nature of stars, and it's one of the many reasons why I never tire of making them. Of course, a well-stocked pantry makes the preparation of stars much, much simpler. The ingredients, for the most part, are not expensive. Magnetic fields are most important, and for a good garden is an absolute must for providing the necessary elements. My garden is modest, only a few cubic parsecs in size, about 100,000 billion 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 cubic yards or so. It provides me with all the hydrogen, helium, and trace elements necessary to make perfect stars every time. To start, take a cloud with about 10,000 solar masses of material. The cloud will be rotating, which is a problem because, of course, angular momentum is conserved. This is often very troubling to novices since the traditional methods won't help here. But remember that flexibility is an important part of being a good and creative cook. So instead of dealing with each part of the cloud individually, add a magnetic field to transfer some of the angular momentum from the entire cloud to the surrounding medium. Don't rush this step. You need to wait a full million or even 10 million years before proceeding if you want a perfect star. You can put this time to good use, though. There's always plenty to do around the house, and lots of suggestions can be found in my new book, Martha Stellar's Helpful Hints for Heavenly Households. Ah, that looks so great. Your cloud should now be relatively smooth, with just a few lumps here and there. At this point, add some random motion to the mixture and watch as that's turbulent fragments into smaller and smaller pieces. Each one of these pieces can be turned into a perfect star, and the next article will show how.
KWMR Point Reyes Station.
KWMR Community Radio is underwritten by Loose Joints Records, a vinyl record store in downtown Point Reyes Station. Loose Joints also buys used records. More info at loosejointsrecords.com or on their Instagram at loosejointsrecords.
Take KWMR with you when you're headed beyond the forests, beaches, and hidden hollows of West Marin. Go online, www.kwmr.org, and click on the play button to stream us live, whenever, wherever. It's your favorite radio to go.
A Briefer History of Time by Eric Schulman. 8.99 billion years BC. Massive star formation, in which a massive star is formed. Stars in the making. In the last article, I showed you how to turn some giant molecular cloud into some lovely protostars. And now it's time to learn how to turn one of these into a perfect star. Now, it is imperative that your protostar be cool, between negative 440 and 445 degrees Fahrenheit. That's between 8 and 11 Kelvin for you absolute temperature scale fans. As long as you keep it transparent, the radiation will escape from the center and the temperature will be stable. Remember that you can't get a perfect star if it is heated unevenly during formation, so never skimp on these details. After a few thousand years, the central regions should become dense and begin to collapse faster than the rest. The density and pressure should increase until the central regions, which a temperature of about 3,140 degrees Fahrenheit, at which point the hydrogen molecules, H2, begin to break into hydrogen atoms, spurring further collapse until the temperature of about 53,540 degrees Fahrenheit is reached in the core. This increase in the core temperature should occur over a period of a few hundred thousand years. Remember not to rush things. The surface temperature will increase from negative 270 degrees Fahrenheit to a most satisfactory 4,940 degrees Fahrenheit. At this point, the time required for the next step depends greatly on the final mass you want the star to have. Because I insist on offering only the very best to my guests, I usually make a massive star of about 15 solar masses. And since such stars don't take as long to make, I can create more of them. While a star the mass of the Sun would take 40 million years to complete, the protostar phase of 15 solar mass star needs only 60,000 years. Of course, the more massive star will live for only 10 million years rather than 10 billion. But that can be an advantage since I like to redecorate fairly frequently. Also, the more massive star is more luminous by a factor of 21,000 and hotter. It has a surface temperature of 60,000 degrees Fahrenheit rather than 10,000 degrees, and has a larger diameter by a factor of 10. Still, since less massive stars are cool, they are red, so I sometimes make a number of low-mass stars just for a little variety in color. Remember, the star clusters you create, you can be elaborate, elegant, and quite substantial at the same time. Don't forget that the final mass of each star will depend somewhat on the environment of the protostar. Be sure to prepare the region ahead of time so there will be no errors. Okay, we're about ready to finish up here. Just a few more details. In the final stages, the core temperature increases to a few hundred thousand degrees Fahrenheit. The hydrogen is ionized, and then the star contracts to its final radius. Once the core temperature is high enough, millions of degrees Fahrenheit, nuclear fusion commences, and a new star is born. Remember that throughout this process, Organization is of the utmost importance. Make sure that your ingredients are ready when they are needed. Knowing when and where to add more material is absolutely essential for making a perfect star. For example, if the star rotates too quickly, it could end up with an active surface and will not make for a lovely presentation. And with stars, as with so many other things, presentation makes perfect. 8.99 billion years BC. Stellar evolution, in which stars evolve and eventually die. Okay, stellar recruits, it's time for you to learn what's really in store for you. I know that before you signed up to be a massive star, you read the fancy brochures that talked about how brightly you'd be shining and how you'd be visible from halfway across the galaxy. But you morons must not have bothered to read the fine print that said you'd explode in 7 million years. And if you did read it, then you're even stupider than you look. 7 million years is not a long time. Now you're burning hydrogen to helium deep inside you, and your core is getting denser and denser. After that little 7 million year vacation is over, you poor slobs will have used up all the hydrogen close to your center. Your core will collapse under its own weight until it becomes hot enough to start fusing helium. Meanwhile, outside the core, you shrinking violets will contract until the hydrogen there is hot enough to fuse. You know what will happen to the energy from this fusion? It will be transmitted to your outer layers, and you'll swell up to 100 times your original size. After that, you have less than 1 million years before you go out with a bang as a supernova. If you're lucky, you'll wind up being a neutron star. But knowing your type, you'll probably end up as a black hole and turn into a singularity with infinite density and zero volume. You recruits act like you're almost dense enough already. You could have chosen to be a lower mass star, you know. Then your hydrogen would have lasted billions or trillions of years. You'd still have gone through a giant phase, but after fusing helium to carbon, you'd have settled down and slowly cooled off as a white dwarf. Now that's a pleasant retirement. Of course, knowing you, you probably have hung out with some loose star, gotten too much mass from them, and be completely disrupted in a supernova explosion. Your type makes me sick. Okay, enough chatter. Time for you to use those ultraviolet photons of yours to clean up this molecular cloud. There's dust everywhere, and your mothers aren't even here to clean it up for you. Go to it. Now, on the double. 8.98 billion years BC. The galaxy. Iron production, in which iron is produced in the core of a massive star, resulting in disaster. Once upon a time, there were three stars. A little star, 0.1 solar masses, a medium star, 1 solar mass, and a big star, 25 solar masses. All three were busy fusing hydrogen to helium, but because their masses were not the same, they each went about it in a different way. The little star shone only as brightly as it thought wise and used up its hydrogen fuel very slowly. Even though it had 10 times less hydrogen than the medium star, it knew that its hydrogen would last 300 times longer, 3 trillion years, in fact. The medium star used up its hydrogen in 10 billion years and then started fusing helium to carbon and oxygen. But the helium only lasted 1 billion years, after which the medium star decided to be content with being a slowly cooling white dwarf. But the big star was boastful and proud.
"I'm more massive than my siblings. I will show them how brightly I can shine."
Even though it had 25 times more hydrogen than the medium star, it used it up 1,400 times faster, and the hydrogen only lasted 7 million years. Then the big star started fusing helium to carbon, but that only lasted 500,000 years. In desperation, it started to fuse carbon to neon, which only lasted 600 years. After that, it tried fusing neon 1 year, oxygen 6 months, and silicon 1 day.
it was left with a core of 1.5 solar masses of iron at a temperature of 10 billion degrees Fahrenheit. And unfortunately for the big star, the protons and neutrons in iron nuclei are so tightly bound together that iron fusion doesn't produce energy. Now, the big star felt as though 7 billion 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 elephants were pressing down on its core, and the temperature rose even more until energetic photons completely disintegrated the iron nuclei. Within a fraction of a second, the core of the star imploded. The moral of the story? The big star thought that 7 million years was a long time and that it didn't have to worry about such a distant future. After the hydrogen was gone, it realized that such wasteful energy production may not have been the wisest course of action, but it was too late to do anything about it. 8.98 billion years BC, supernova explosion, in which a massive star ends its life by exploding.
Hum Parsec to Star Command. Come in, Star Command. This is Hum Parsec reporting from Milky Way Galaxy. My survey has just begun, and I found something interesting. Come in, Star Command.
This is Star Command, Parsec. We read you. What have you to report?
I found a star that's about to explode, Star Command. According to my neutrino detector, silicon burning should be almost complete. There it goes. The core has collapsed. The density in the interior of the star is so high, the electrons are combining with protons to make neutrons, which is releasing a billion, 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 billion neutrinos.
Don't get cocky, Parsec. Even though individual neutrinos very rarely interact with matter, that many neutrinos could easily fry you. Remember, we need your report.
Luckily for me, the density in the core is high enough that the neutrinos can't all escape immediately, so I'm safe for the moment. According to my measurements, the inner regions of the star are collapsing at almost 15% the speed of light. They're about to hit the newly formed neutron star. Wow! What a shockwave! The material has rebounded and is flying away from the center of the star. It's going to take a few hours for the shock wave to reach the outer parts of the star, but meanwhile, the star densities and neutrino fluxes are triggering fusion in the material and creating a whole host of elements heavier than iron.
Get out of there, Parsec. That supernova will soon be more luminous than all the other stars in the galaxy combined.
Roger that. I'm out of here. Come in, Star Command. This is Hum Parsec again. I'm safely away from the supernova, and I am now able to report on the effects it is having on the surrounding area. Nearby clouds of hydrogen and helium gas are being compressed by a force of the explosion, and the heavy elements it created are being mixed with the clouds. Some of these clouds are not dense enough to become protostars, but the amount of metals is probably too small to create planets. After a few more cycles of star formation and supernova explosions, however, this galaxy will almost certainly be full of stars with planetary systems.
Make a full report of potential planetary systems and be sure to let us know if you find any that might be capable of supporting life. The galaxy is depending on you, Hum Parsec.
Will do. This is Hum Parsec, signing off.
4.6 billion years BC, the solar system. Star formation, in which the sun forms. The following message is brought to you by GALSA, the Galactic Association of Licensed Stellar Agents. Because you wouldn't want to trust your planets to just any star. We are so glad you chose GALSA Star Buyer's Agent to find the right star for us. My husband and I wanted a star with a big enough habitable zone that we could have life on at least one planet, and we didn't have a lot of resources to spend. The buyer's agent showed us seven stars between 0.8 and 0.9 solar masses, but they just weren't right for us. Because they were looking in the 0.8 and 0.9 solar mass range, I knew that the surface temperature of these stars would be on the low side for their purposes. The stars would be emitting only 30 to 60% of the energy that one solar mass star emits. But since they told me the mass range they'd be comfortable with, I had to trust them that they knew what they wanted, so I only showed them stars in that mass range. The GALSA buyer's agent didn't put any pressure on us to increase our desired stellar mass range, even after we didn't find anything we liked. But my husband and I talked it over and decided we had the resources to go up to 1.0 solar masses after all. Once they raised their threshold to 1.0 solar masses, I had a much larger number of suitable stars that I could show them. They picked out 5 to examine in detail. The first 3 stars were just okay, and the 4th one my husband liked because it was in a good neighborhood. But I just fell in love with the 5th star we looked at. It was exactly 1.0 solar masses, and there were 9 planets forming around it, one of which was at a distance of 93 million miles from the star. Stars produce more energy with time, so the location of the habitable zone changes, but we calculated that this planet would be habitable for at least 6 billion years, by which time we would have long since retired. By then, any life forms we decided to have should have been big enough to take care of themselves. I'm glad that you were able to find a star that would make them happy, and I'm glad that I was able to help. I do a lot of big business throughout the galaxy, but young couples finding their first star system always remind me of why I'm in the star system business in the first place. Since we were planning on having little ones, we had the usual lead and radon inspections done. They found only 1 part per billion of lead and no detectable radon in the star, which set our minds at ease. After getting a loan for the necessary resources, we signed the final papers and the star system was ours. And we owe it all to our GALSA buyer's agent. 4.5 billion years BC. Planetary differentiation, in which the planet Earth forms. Welcome back to The Planet Show on the Galactic Value Channel. On the phone, we have Marcia, who just bought P21668, Jupiter. Hello, Marcia. How has your day been so far? It's been great, just great, Tammy. How has your day been? Well, it's been wonderful. Tell me, Marcia, what made you decide to purchase Jupiter? Well, I'll tell you. When I saw that it was forming in the outer solar system where the temperature is low and water could condense to form icy planetesimals, I knew that it would end up being massive enough to hold on to all its hydrogen and helium, and that it would be large enough to be a fantastic new fashion staple. Having so many moons was an added bonus for me. Also, I don't have a lot of time to wait for delivery, so the fact that it would only take 10 million years to form was important to me. Well, Marcia, it was great talking to you, and I'm sure you'll enjoy your new planet. Now it's time for today's special value, P62164, the Earth. And it's safe to say it will not last. It's a terrestrial planet, which, as you know, is a number one best-selling planetary type in our GVC collection. First, let me show you the width. As you can see, it comes in at just about 8,000 miles. The Earth and other terrestrial planets are forming close to the Sun out of the kilometer-sized chunks of rock. Because the temperature in the inner solar system is too high for ice to survive, the terrestrial planets have only about 10% of the planetesimals available to the outer planets, and therefore will not become massive enough to hold on to hydrogen and helium. It will be a beautiful mixture of brown and blue, with about 70% of its surface covered by water. Isn't that wonderful? Just imagine relaxing in your very own ocean after a long, hard day. Big oceans like this are perfect for entertaining. You could have the whole solar neighborhood over. Oh my goodness! Today's special value had just sold out, you know? When I saw that it was on the schedule, I heard the writing on the wall and just knew it would go fast. Let's talk now with the buyer. Hi, Charlene, and welcome to The Planet Show. How are you? I'm just fine. How are you? I'm doing great. Tell me, Charlene, why did you go for this planet? Well, you know, it's just so versatile. And when I saw that it was a special value, I knew I had to have it, even though it will take 100 million years to completely form. I was especially impressed by the way in which molten iron will percolate down through the silicate mantle and produce a spinning metallic core. I like my planets to have magnetic fields, you know, and that's one of the best ways to get one. It surely is, Charlene. Please tell us how you're going to use your new planet. Well, it looks so terrific that I'm sure it's going to be a beautiful complement to my other planets. After the formation process is mostly complete, I'm expecting an atmosphere to form from the emission of volatile gases from volcanoes, as well as from comet impacts. I might even decide to evolve some life down there. Well, you know, Charlene, if you're looking to have life on your planet, then you might want to look into our giant moon option, which will help keep the tilt of the planet's spin axis constant and therefore provide a more stable environment for your organisms. It's a little bit more expensive, however. Why is that, Tammy? In order to get such a large moon, we would have to smash a protoplanet a few times more massive than Mars into the Earth. But I think the extra cost would be well worth it for you. That sounds just great. I'll definitely go for the giant moon option. Well, thank you so much for shopping on GVC, Charlene, and enjoy your new planet. Oh, I will, Tammy. Goodbye. Bye now. You take care. 4.4 billion years BC, the Earth, volatile gas expulsion, in which the atmosphere of the Earth is produced. A forming planet. Giant impacts destroy the early atmosphere. To the new planet, asteroids and comets give volatile gases. Volcanoes emit water, carbon dioxide, and other gases. Ultraviolet light dissociates some water, making oxygen. Carbon dioxide in excess will heat the Earth. Balance is needed. CO2 dissolves to form carbonic acid, H2CO3. H2CO3 on rocks produces limestone, CaCO3. Subducted limestone feeds volcanoes that release carbon dioxide. High temperatures mean more evaporation and dissolved CO2. As the CO2 gets turned into limestone, the temperature falls. Low temperatures mean less evaporation, and CO2 builds up. Then CO2 then acts to heat the atmosphere, rising temperatures. The cycle goes on for billions of years. Watch as the sun gets brighter. A bright sun means that less heating is needed, more CO2 in rocks. On the early Earth, there was 1,000 times more carbon dioxide. Our atmosphere is a very nice temperature. Thank our friends, the rocks. 4 billion years BC, molecular reproduction, in which life on Earth begins. It was a dark and stormy night. In the shallow tide pool, a nucleic acid base collided with a sugar molecule. An amino acid sank beneath the murky depths. The tide pool had once been connected to the sea, but since then an army of sluggish days had marched by and evaporation had increased the concentration of organic molecules. Things had been tough for a long time, but now it was easier for small chains of molecules to form. The air above the pool smelled of rotten sweetness. A longer chain with a sinister look formed on the clay bottom, and then a speedy molecule slammed into it like brass knuckles on a Ming vase and disappeared into the night. Suddenly, there was a bright flash of light and a giant explosion. A comet had crashed to Earth nearby. In the upper atmosphere, the water, methane, nitrogen, carbon dioxide, and hydrogen sulfide that composed the comet had been shock-heated and converted into dozens of different organic molecules. They sped downward toward the tide pool. The shock wave from the impact hit the pool, increasing the temperature of the water like a match in a bathtub. Still, short chains of molecules were buffeted like a washed-up boxer just before he takes a dive. When the sun rose in the morning, its bright ultraviolet light sped things up. Many complex chains of molecules were formed in the newly enriched tide pool. One of the new chains had the unique property that it could reproduce itself using molecules in the tide pool as raw materials. The simple molecules of the tide pool began to feel like swimmers with concrete galoshes. It didn't take long before most of the bit players had been consumed and the tide pool was filled with copies of the new chain. Then a high tide came in and washed many of the big boys out to sea, where they began to prey upon a new set of short, helpless chains of molecules. The long chains of molecules continued to reproduce themselves in a shallow bay near the tide pool by feasting upon the smaller chains in the area. Some of the long chains lost the ability to produce reproducing copies of themselves, but every so often a molecular chain formed that could reproduce itself even better than the rest, and soon the area was swarming with this kind of chain. The process led from complex chains of molecules to even more complicated groups of molecules. Today, we call them bacteria. 4 billion years ago, they were the first life on Earth. And I think that's a good stopping point here. We're on page 41. We'll stop and come back next week on Monday. By the way, I'm Matt Gallagher reading. I'm filling in for Amanda Eichstadt here in Studio A. Reading A Briefer History of Time from the Big Bang to Big Mac by Eric Schulman, which is a Creative Commons license and allows us to read this, even though it was updated in 2004. And, of course, it is made off of a bit of a parody of A Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking. I just want to also let people know that I had practiced to read the first couple chapters of A Briefer History of Time, and it wasn't this text. So I had this text in my hands just minutes before I got to the station. I'm sorry I didn't get to really read what I was thinking I was reading. There is another Briefer History of Time, which is not a Creative Commons license. It's actually an updated version with of the Stephen Hawking original book, and it is not free of the copyright, and we don't have the right on KWMR to read it. So my apologies for any stumblings and fumblings there. I'm just going to let the next show get going, which I don't know because I don't know my Mondays. I should probably go on to KWMR website here and tell you what that is. Here's the shows. It's Today. It's Turning Pages. Oh, we got Bioneers from 11 to 11:30. Bioneers is coming up next. Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun to read this, and I will be back, and we will continue with Eric Schulman's A Briefer History of Time from the Big Bang to the Big Mac next week at 10 o'clock, and we'll see how life is forming here when we pick up with protein construction, in which protons are made from amino acids. Thank you so much.